This episode of Let's Talk About Sex with Lynn and Jen is not intended as a substitute for seeing your own mental health provider. We are here to initiate conversations about sex.
Let's keep the conversations going. You can find us on Twitter at TalkingSexPod or email us at TalkingSexPodcast@gmail.com. We also want to give special thanks to Nathan Diffie for our podcast cover art and our wonderful editor, Julia W.D. Harrison. Lynn Ponton and I, Jennifer Wong, are the executive producers. This week's spotlight, we're going to be talking about a couple different things.
I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Hello, this is Lynn of Let's Talk About Sex with Lynn and Jen. And today we have a very interesting and very important subject for America and actually for the world. And this topic was brought up to us, Jen, by our editor. We have an editor that makes the sound as good as it is for you, named Julia. And she works in Fremont and works with some of the homeless programs there, and has strongly pointed out to us that navigation centers are needed for the homeless that live in Fremont. So we're going to be talking today about the need for these navigational centers, but also about sex and the homeless, which we think is a really, really interesting topic. We've done a lot of work on it, and we're bringing our own experience to this, and we'd like to hear from the listeners.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot to cover today, and what I'm excited about is, it's kind of a sad thing, but it's also an exciting thing. It's sad because when I was trying to do some of the research for this, there really isn't that much research out there on this topic. And so that's sad because it's a very important thing to talk about, sex and sexuality. And at the same time, though, I think it invites a lot of discussion. So it gives us a fresh topic to talk about and a different angle to approach this with.
It's interesting reading those articles. We did find a number, and we have our own vast clinical experience in this area. For about 10 years, I was the psychiatrist in San Francisco for the homeless prevention programs before they dissolved. And I think that's very important to say that, because San Francisco is now known for all of the homeless that are on the streets, and we see them every day on our way out, our way to work, by our homes. But there used to be a fair amount of homeless prevention that prevented this situation here.
Yeah, the homeless situation has gotten much more intensified, definitely. And I actually didn't know that they had dissolved the Larkin Street Youth Center. That was the program that I had been planning to go into as a volunteer right before grad school. So I ended up not doing it because I got into grad school. But
it wasn't, I think Larkin Street is still running.
Oh, okay.
So it's important to say that.
Okay.
Boy, we better really get that out there.
Yeah.
But it was Waller Street.
Oh, and, okay. The homeless
prevention.
About a different program.
Exactly. Then. I worked at both, but the homeless prevention program, it was run out of Waller Street, and it had a psychiatric component, early intervention, work with mothers and children, with domestically abused moms. And so it was really great. And I was their consultant roughly about 10 years. They got rid of the program because of lack of funding, and they were dependent on some city funding for that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I'm so sad to hear they did that, because as we're going to be talking about more today, the community aspect of these types of interventions is so important in tackling the situation with homelessness.
And a lot of the authors of the articles we'll talk about, but a lot of the authors talk about homelessness begins when relationships end. And there's a lack of connection. And then people do really drift away from others.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of families and people out there that are stepping up and helping out others and really trying to prevent people from becoming homeless.
Right. I mean, there's also definitely, I remember we talked about I'd have to go back and look through our records, but there was a New York Times article about the family who was not able to get their adult son admitted for psychiatric care. So there's definitely a lot of different components that are not syncing up together. But I think today, one of the aspects we're going to tackle here is really about the intimate relationships. And that doesn't necessarily mean just physical intimacy, but also emotional intimacy.
Yeah, and all of these articles really talk about the fact that the centers that currently exist and the programs and many of the therapists who work with the homeless do not provide a place for discussion or activity regarding sexuality. And that didn't surprise me for a lot of reasons, but I think it's important for people to know that that's really excluded from any sort of programmatic or care offered to the homeless.
Well, what struck me was this was looking at a study that was examining schizophrenic patients that have schizophrenia, and it was talking about the physicians who work with them and how when the physicians are asked to rate whether or not they're comfortable talking about sexual dysfunction, I believe it's like 70% who say they are comfortable. And then they're also asked, though, whether or not they initiate those discussions. And it's something like 2/3 say they do not initiate the discussions. And so they say they're comfortable, but there's also this piece of they're waiting on the client or the patient to be the one to address the issue.
And that is really something key to point out. And we were talking a little bit about it before this taping. And I have worked as a psychiatrist with a lot of schizophrenic bipolars and all groups really of psychotic individuals, and I've had them in therapy for fairly long times, getting medications and some not, and some struggling basically. But I've worked very hard to initiate discussions of sexuality. Of course, you and I were working on the book Sex Lives, and we're interested in this topic. And I try hard to do that. All these patients say that the other therapists are not talking about it at all. And you pointed out to me, Jen, that most therapists and most people think of the seriously mentally ill as being asexual.
Right.
So the assumption is, because they've got this major illness, that they're really asexual or sex is not a big part of their life. I also wonder, you know, I think about prejudice against the seriously mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Maybe the prejudice is they shouldn't be having a sexual life or sexual activity because they are impaired. It's kind of it's a really horrible thing to say. But I pick that up occasionally from parents of very sick people I'm working with and from the culture at large. Well, we don't want them having sex or having children or anything like that.
Right. I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of stigma in that aspect. And I think that also plays into what I was talking about earlier with the physicians not asking about it. Because if there's this fundamental belief that people that are diagnosed as seriously mentally ill, they are asexual, then of course you're not going to think to ask about it.
Right. On the psych units, which now are very short term for the seriously mentally ill, and by that I mean in the United States, the average length of stay is under a couple of days, really. So it doesn't do much other than prevent immediate homicidality or suicidality. But on those units, sexual activity is usually prohibited.
Right.
Because the viewpoint is that the power imbalance with a person with serious mental illness, acute, would not be able to engage in a reciprocal relationship. That's a little bit different than the acute episode of a psychotic individual. It's a little bit different, though, than a whole sexual life and the role that sexuality might play in a whole life.
Right. I mean, so in reading this article called Sexual Intimacy, Mental Illness and Homelessness by John Ecker, Rebecca Turner, Jennifer Ray, and Conrad Chakowski, what they bring up is that we really have to take this community viewpoint and look at it as how can all these pieces of a person's community come together. And one of the things that drove me to print this article out in particular was I was really drawn to the way their research looked at highlighting the importance of having intimate relationships and how that helps people that are severely mentally ill, but also people who are homeless, because a lot of the homeless will isolate themselves and withhold from engaging in trying to have relationships. And that plays into them staying in their homeless situation. And I think what a navigation center can do is it builds a community for people so they can build these types of relationships and really transition into more stable housing situations.
And that, in a sense, was what the program was at Waller Street, the homeless prevention. There were groups that they participated in. There was efforts to get housing, you know, that temporary housing that prevented it. There was child care. So the idea that connections would be made that prevent them from going to the homeless state is really, really key.
Because I think that's one of the things that pains me so much about the situation in San Francisco. I mean, it's in other cities too, but I'm a native San Franciscan.
Yes.
Is the way we really marginalize the homeless people. And there's so much of these sort of punitive efforts happening where they're destroying the tent camps. And like the tent camps obviously have issues too, but just like moving them out of sight doesn't actually address the real issues that lead people to be in such a situation.
Absolutely. And to talk a little bit about it, anyone who lives in the Bay Area or Seattle now,
Los Angeles,
California is very affected by this situation. You know, you have to come to your own terms with how to deal with it. And you know, a couple of things that work for me, and they're not the be-all and the end-all, but I feel like when you see homeless people, you greet them as if, you know them and you're trying to develop some relationality. So it's important, I think, to acknowledge them and to not completely look away, mm-hmm. as many do, and then to engage in some effort to address the issues and problems that they're having as part of our community.
I mean, I think part of the issue, too, is that some people on some level are aware that a lot of people in the United States, because of the state of our healthcare, are not that far away from potential homelessness. So I think that creates a big anxiety for people against engaging with the homelessness, and they'd rather just not look at it.
I think you're right, Jen, because, you know, we also work with a lot of other patients here, and they talk about this problem, too.
Right.
And a lot of people don't want to see it. They'll move away from a neighborhood that has a lot of homeless people there.
Mm-hmm.
They won't go to the theater if there's a theater where there's a lot of homeless people outside of it. So they're trying to really push away from that problem. And the problem moves with us, with all of the people. It's mm-hmm. here with us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not really the way to deal with it. And that gets back to ideas like the navigation center or working in some capacity,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of us to think about this kind of a human think tank,
right.
about how to really address these issues and making some personal contribution.
Right. And I think it comes back to really that relational, you know, component. I almost forgot the word I was trying to talk about. But yeah, it comes back to the relational component. And also, I think, I can't remember, it was in this article that I brought up, but they were talking about how for those patients that were schizophrenic, they wanted their physicians to bring up the topic of sexuality, and not just from a sexual dysfunction place, but really from a having a healthy sexual life position, a more sex positive position.
And I strongly believe that a healthy sexual life helps your mental life. It helps everything.
Yeah.
Helps your physical life by keeping you physical and healthy longer. As I age, I certainly recognize that a healthy sexual life gets blood flow, gets everything.
Yeah.
You're really more present in the world with that. So it's very, very healing in a lot of ways. And it's a healing piece that we kind of leave out of the treatment plans for people.
Well, also, even not just talking about the physical component, having an intimate relationship with someone, they talk about it, but it helps people with their self-esteem. It helps them have confidence. We've talked about the importance of being able to take risks. And part of being able to engage in healthy risk-taking is being able to assess healthy risk-taking. And a lot of that happens through dialogue.
Yeah, and that type of intimate relationship.
Yeah.
I've worked with, maybe talk about one of the young men I've worked with a major psychotic illness where he's had psychotic episodes and sometimes takes meds and sometimes doesn't. So it's right. Ongoing really around that. But you know, he has struggled really to have a sexual life. And, you know, it is a balance. We've got to bring it up in every session. You know, I've got to stay on top of, is there a, you know, a power balance in the relationship where he's not taking advantage of his partner or she's not taking advantage of him?
Yeah.
There's a lot of issues that have to be dealt with in the therapy around that. But I have accepted, you know, and really acknowledge that it's a priority to him to really have this be part of our discussions. So we really work hard on that subject. And it's not always easy, you know, because there are other factors that play in with a psychotic illness and a sexual life. And it's really, really a challenge, both, I think, for him and also for me to figure out how to make that work.
I think also with some of the severe mental illnesses that have a serious anxiety framework, an anxious frame, that adds a whole other component to being able to engage in or initiate a relationship. And so I think as clinicians, it's important for clinicians to be taught about how to manage that aspect and help their clients manage that aspect in their lives.
You're right, Jen, because many of our patients are more isolated, more anxious, the anxious, isolated individual, and not floridly psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And with individuals like that, they really are not able to engage and move outward. And I have a lot of patients like that where we're trying to develop their skills and also have them engage with other people at the same time, you know, reduce their anxiety. So it's really a kind of a multi-pronged program to get them to change things in their lives.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about some of the clients I've worked with who have been diagnosed with bipolar and how that impacts the way they're able to perceive their partner connecting or disconnecting. And I think that's another piece that obviously, you know, brings up its own challenges.
Yeah. Sexuality runs through all of these individuals' lives. And, you know, some of the early studies indicated that individuals with bipolar actually have greater periods of sexuality and then lesser. And, you know, many have quite developed sexual lives. Whereas with schizophrenics, the feeling was that they don't have as much of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think with individuals who suffer from schizophrenia, one of the real issues is the isolation you were talking about and some of the fears that develop with it. But I think if you're working with individuals with major mental illness, you really have to do everything you can to help them with this piece of their treatment in their life.
And I think part of what inspired me so much to like work on this book with you and learn more about sexuality and talk more about it with my clients is I see how much sexuality is a part of our life, but we don't talk about it as if it's this big piece of our identity. It's seen as this sort of compartmentalized, separate piece of our lives. But the more we talk about it, I think last week we were talking about Jamie and he's 3 and he's already, you know, looking at gender roles. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Your grandson. Sorry. I forgot to mention that. But so you see, like, even at 3, and definitely I know on the flip side, I've worked with clients who are in their 70s and they're talking about feeling that they can't have a sexual life, but they want one. And so it really is just all throughout your life. And it's a piece of who you are.
A very important piece. I have a a few patients in their 90s. You know, as you get older, you have older patients.
Sure.
And for them too, you know, one particular woman, she's in her 90s, and she has a vivid sexual life in her dreams and her writing.
Oh.
And so it comes up in our conversations regularly.
Yeah.
And she's got a more active sexual life and discussion with her therapist.
Sure.
You know, than most people do. So I think it's there, and it really aids her identity when she can talk about it. She can write about it. It really makes her mood improve. It affects everything, really, for her.
Yeah, and I think I almost laugh about it now, because when I first started out doing therapy, like I never thought to talk about sex with my clients. And now I almost like can't imagine not talking about something related to sex and sexuality, because it's so core to who we are as people.
Right. You know, and of course, they always joke about Freud and everything is sexual. And it isn't everything is sexual, but sexuality is part of everything.
Right. You know, exactly.
A little bit of a difference.
It is different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, back to what we've discovered really with these studies, one of the things that interested me is that for women, 90% of the women who are homeless suffer domestic violence.
Yeah.
And that's the road that gets them out on the street. And so we look at women on the street, and I think for all of us to keep in mind that domestic violence is really behind it. And I know many people look at individuals on the street and they think of mental illness, they think of substance use, all of those things as being part of it. But I think it's very important to realize the large amount of domestic abuse that is putting people out there. And if we get rid of a domestic abuse program, we're going to have more people on the street. You know, it's that kind of connection.
And I think that also brings up some of the challenges with having these homeless shelters, is that what happens when you have a person who is escaping domestic violence? I think that's really great that they're getting away from that situation. You want them to be in stable housing. And they're also more susceptible to being in some type of power, unequal relationship with a person, and because of the situation that they've just escaped. And so there's no, I think what makes these types of situations so challenging is there are no easy answers. But I think it is important to at least address these different issues. And I'm glad that you brought up that statistic in particular, because that was something I wasn't aware of until reading about.
Yeah, there are special shelters
right.
for women who are really escaping violent situations where you can take your children.
Right.
And I think to know what those shelters are, you know, even one potential connection with homeless people that we could have is really carry some cards, you know, from a shelter in our area and then give them, you know, to women on the street. So there are ways that we could really help and be, you know, out there. I think people don't want to give money to the homeless. There's a lot of issues around that. But other ways to give them something is really important.
Well, I think most importantly is even looking at this, that intimate relationships really help people feel good about themselves and care about themselves. So you don't need to become best friends with your local homeless person, right? But to acknowledge that they're there, to not just walk past them, to not try and pretend that they don't exist. One thing that you had brought up, and also our other assistant Soy had brought up earlier, was that when she was visiting Canada, she had a very different experience with the homeless people there. Can you talk a little bit about?
Yes, and just to say, a lot of these articles come out of Canada. The United States does really very little work in this area. And we have bigger problems than anywhere else, but
well, we have a lot of issues with sex and sexuality here.
Right, exactly. But this article you were talking about by John Acker et al. Is really comes out of Toronto. Many of the others are combined pieces out of Montreal, BC, you know, British Columbia, all of these things. So there's a lot of studies coming out of Canada.
Yeah.
And then one out of Italy that I thought was particularly kind of forward thinking. But Canada does have programs for the homeless. There are fewer people on the street. The weather, of course, is inclement and not exactly conducive to living outside, even in a tent. And having spent time living there growing up, I really just the mere thought of being in a tent in the winter in Winnipeg would be scary. Again, I think there's not as much judgment from Canada that you're a bad person or you deserve homelessness or you ended up there for that for a reason that is totally attributable to you.
Right.
You know, so the less judgment makes it easier, I think, to handle some of the individuals involved with this.
Mm-hmm.
They do have more social programs. One of my old, flames probably from late adolescence, he's involved as a social worker in Canada.
Yeah.
And a lot of the programs in Montreal are really great.
Doing great work.
Yeah,
there.
Doing great work. So I think it's really important that we look at other models other than the United States, because the United States is really struggling with a lot of negative issues. And here we are in one of the wealthiest areas, the Bay Area, and we have one of the worst problems, really, with homelessness.
Yeah, and I don't think that's actually a coincidence.
I don't think so either. A couple things. I think the people here are not necessarily the most generous. So the wealthiest people are not necessarily the most giving, connected, relational, or generous. So that's one factor involved. And there's more of the idea here, I believe, that it's these people's fault or responsibility for being on the street or being homeless.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that negative value that goes with it. And what you were talking about, Jen, distancing from the homeless people. Well, I don't want to be there. I'm going to work even harder, make more money, and not be there. And it's a weird dynamic that's going on here.
I think to add to that, too, is that what I think about is, in terms of trying to tackle this large issue of the expanding homelessness population, I had a conversation with my husband where we were talking about what would be the most effective group to target. And I think it actually would be, and he also agreed, was we really have to put a lot of our effort into the most recently homeless, because they are the ones who still, I think, have the closest potential connection, and you can reintegrate them more readily back into society and back into housing. So that's not to say that we're like totally ignoring some of the people who have been chronically homeless, but I think in order to lessen the numbers, you really have to look at what are these driving factors that help people out of homelessness. And I think a big part of the recently homelessness, if we're looking at articles like this, it's looking at those relationships. And so they fell upon a hard time, obviously, or they wouldn't be homeless. But it also means they're more likely to have some of these social networks to pull on if they have a place like a navigation center where they can stabilize themselves and build connections and kind of regroup.
And that's a great title for it, a navigation center, to kind of navigate your life and regroup and go in a better direction.
Right.
I agree with you. I think that's what the homeless prevention program tried to do, was the people right at the risk before they're dropping off, and you provide the housing, you provide services, you provide discussion and connection, and then you prevent them from dropping into that population, which is very difficult. That's, I think, very key. The other factor is addressing trauma, the abuse.
Oh, absolutely.
And addressing mental health needs, because many of the chronics on the street are very mentally ill, and they are psychotic.
Yeah.
And they're that population, you know, it's estimated 50 to 70% have major psychiatric illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And a lot of the families I work with are working desperately to keep their family members off the street.
Yeah.
You know, and they go far to do that.
Yeah.
So that's another group that could use a lot of help. I think families working to keep a mentally ill person in a home setting, there should be a navigational center for them.
Well, that's why it really is about coming back to, like, what are some of these community ideas? And I think often there's a lot of resistance to building a navigation center because people are worried it will draw in, you know, basically crazy homeless people. But I think when you look at how they actually function and the statistics and, like, the services provided, you can see it's actually about helping homeless people reintegrate into society, which is the best potential or possible outcome.
No, it's a great idea. And we're going to put on our website, actually, a petition to support the development of these centers, you know, the one in Fremont. And if people could sign that, listeners, we greatly appreciate that. But it gets back to more open discussion of what can be done really about this problem. So kind of a social piece and the sexuality is part of it. You know, it's a key part of it.
It's a key part of it. And I think it's really important that we talk about this piece because it's so integral to us as people. And I think sometimes people don't see homeless people with the same sort of lens.
Yeah, and, you know, stigma is a really big part of it. And then distancing. I'm not like those people. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be those people. So they really don't want to look at the problems that are involved with them.
Well, I think that's part of it. Yeah. I think the other part is the internalized stigma. A lot of people who fall into homelessness also have those beliefs. And it keeps them from seeking out resources. And it keeps them from engaging in these types of relationships that might help them build some social connections.
Right. You bring up for me that when I was working at Waller Street in this program, that many individuals who became homeless could not really reach out to former connections because they felt very embarrassed about their situation.
And
it was very, very difficult to really reach back out of that and how to initiate that. We had individuals who would call their friends and family with them and try to get them to reconnect. And that's a really great way, I think, to deal with it. You know, one other thing I've seen in the Bay Area that works, I'm going to plug a little business nearby called Sunny Country, and it's a little family-run grocery store in the middle of San Francisco. But what the owners do is they hire homeless people and they do their own support program. And then they reconnect those people with their family members all over the United States. And, you know, they've been very successful with this work. And, you know, and that's, you know, they've made a difference, big difference in a few people's lives. And I think that's what we're talking about, is you don't have to change everybody's life, but really reaching out in one small area to make a difference.
I know, I love hearing stories like that. I mean, people as individuals can make such a big difference when we come together.
Right. And this brings us back to the centers and really addressing that, but also back to, as therapists, you know, we can talk in our therapies with all individuals really about their sexual lives, but anyone who is suffering from homelessness, it's really important to keep that in mind, that that's a key part of it, or even if it's being missed, if it's not present, they're still sexual.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is a great subject. We could go on and on about
this.
But I encourage our listeners to go to the website and sign the petition and really to call us back about your ideas.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lynn, and thank you for being our listener.
Come on, let's talk about-